Hurst, you're doing research with fruit flies. What is it that got you interested in fruit flies?
Well, when I was a student, I didn't think I would ever go into fruit fly because I always did classical genetics, and that kind of didn't turn me on. But I became interested during a sort of stint in a lab which worked on fruit flies, and they worked on steroid hormones back then, and I was interested in how a single hormone, which basically sweeps through the entire body, can trigger many different responses in different tissues. And so that was the first problem I was sort of working on. And later I realized how enormously powerful the fruit fly is, because today we are looking at an arsenal of tools that is just mind-boggling. We can manipulate genes and single tissues at specific times. It's like a geneticist's dream, and that's why I love the fruit fly. We can do so many things that are not possible in, you know, higher organisms like the mouse, for instance.
That's it about the fruit fly, that it is so tiny. But then how does it relate to the human being?
It's a good question, and in fact, the entire Drosophila community is certainly debating how we can sort of sell our model organism to, you know, the funding agencies in better ways, because it's been always clear to us that many of the human disease genes are what we call conserved between the fly and the human. So in other words, there is a counterpart that just looks like it and functions in a very similar way. And the beauty about the fruit fly is that we can now manipulate this gene in the fly and discover how it functions, how the pathway it acts in works, and can then apply this knowledge that we gain from the fly back to humans. And you can, of course, then ask, well, why would you go through the fly? Why don't you do it directly in humans or in mice? And the answer is that the pathways are basically stripped down. They are simpler. You don't have like redundant genes, which are multiple copies of the same thing. We have these tools. And of course, the flies, they only need 2 weeks for an generation. So you can much more rapidly get your results. And that's the main reason that we use the fly. And as I said before, the tools that we have available that you cannot do in a mouse or in a human, of course, because of ethical reasons.
So you mentioned that you were doing some work with a particular gene. What is that?
Well, we actually work on multiple genes. Perhaps the one you're referring to, we published not too long ago in PLOS Biology, which is a gene encoding a so-called nuclear receptor. And nuclear receptors are actually really cool proteins. Perhaps you know that you're making estrogen and I'm making testosterone. So we actually have receptors for these molecules in our bodies, and they belong to the same protein family called nuclear receptors. And so we were working on this protein called DHR4, which is short for Drosophila hormone receptor number 4. Not a very creative name, but there it is. And basically we noticed that it was regulating steroid hormone production in a very specific organ. And this protein had a very remarkable behavior that we noticed. And what happened was that this protein was going in and out of the nucleus in a very rapid time frame. So every 4 hours it would go into the nucleus and then would be kicked out 4 hours later. And so we noticed this, what we refer to as an oscillation. And it turned out that this protein blocks steroid hormone production. And we sort of tried to use this as an inroad to dissect this entire pathway. And we ended up finding out that there is this neuropeptide that regulates this travel between the cytoplasm and the nucleus. And this is kind of similar to what happens in humans between, for a neuropeptide called ACTH. And that also governs oscillations of a steroid hormone called glucocorticoids. And so there are interesting parallels. And we basically used our system to, you know, chop away at this pathway and understand how it works.
So this oscillation then, that's a normal sort of thing?
No, it's very unusual. Good point. So most proteins would be either in the nucleus, where all the DNA is, or in a cytoplasm. and do their functions in these respective compartments, as we say. And to have protein going in and out with that rapid kind of behavior, we call that rapid, because if you see any oscillations, they're typically circadian, meaning like once a day, but this happened basically every 4 to 8 hours.
Do you know why it was doing that?
Yeah, so this neuropeptide that we found out that regulated this behavior is a master control peptide for steroid hormone pulses. So that's what our lab is ultimately interested in. So steroid hormones are released in pulses, at least in Drosophila they are, and sometimes this also happens in humans. So what is a pulse? Basically, is like a electromagnetic pulse, you have an activity that goes up and goes down again. So it has a beginning and a peak or an amplitude and a defined end. And we just want to know, how is this regulated? What's the beginning? What defines the beginning? What defines how big the pulse is going to be, and when does it end? So we discovered this DHR4 protein to be a major timer of this event. And so when you knock down, or I should say, if you remove the function of the protein, the animal develops actually faster. So you actually interfered with the timing of the entire animal. And that made it sort of extra interesting for us.
If it's unusual for this to be happening, and when this happens, it makes it develop faster, what kinds of things would be developing faster?
The development of the fruit fly is coordinated by these steroid hormone pulses. So in insects, the steroid hormone is called ecdysone. It's a quite famous hormone in my field, at least. I don't expect it to be famous outside that field. But it acts as a timer. So every pulse signifies an event in the entire animal. Let's say it would say, now we're going to molt, which means that the larva sheds its cuticle and makes a new cuticle so it can accommodate growth. So what happened was that these pulses occurred more frequently when we knocked down or knocked out the function of this protein. So the entire development of the animal was accelerated, but coordinately and in a manner that wasn't lethal to the animal. It just went faster. It's like if you would have the equivalent problem in human, you would basically enter puberty much faster than you would see in a normal, non-mutated human.
So is this an interesting development, or is it something you think can be applied?
Well, first of all, is it interesting? Well, it is interesting because it's a very rare type of mutation. Understanding how the timing of steroid hormone pulses is regulated is not very well understood, neither in flies nor in humans. And on top of that, mutations that sort of accelerate development are exceedingly rare. So we really want to understand how this works out mechanistically. We think we understand the mechanism, at least at a deeper level than we did like 2 years ago. Can it be applied? I don't know if you want to have faster developing humans. I think.
But you could have faster developing lab flies and do that turnover.
Yeah, maybe accelerate it so that we have like a 1 week cycle. Yeah, the problem would be there's a payoff. With every mutation, despite being viable, these guys are actually small. So the payoff, or the trade-off, I should say, is that these animals don't have the time to feed as long as they should. So they are actually ending up quite small.
What are some of the other things that you found out?
Yeah, so what I love about basic research is that you are looking into new things that you have never thought of before, and you stumble upon things that are remarkable and, keep you excited. So a recent discovery we made actually relates directly to a human disease that I heard of before, but it's kind of obscure because it's rather rare. So what happened with this mutation we found recently, which is not directly related to this protein we just talked about, but something new we found in a so-called genetic screen where we look for new stuff. We found this gene that encodes a nerve growth factor. And what happened was that when you knock down this nerve growth factor, that the organ that makes the steroid hormone becomes A, giant, so it's overgrown, and B, it turned completely red when you expose it to UV light, which is a bizarre phenotype. I never heard of this before. So normally tissues in a fly would be transparent, and if you expose them to UV light, they should be transparent. But this particular mutant turned this particular, well, actually it wasn't a mutant, it was a tissue-specific gene interference. That tissue was fluorescing in bright red. Turns out there's a human disease called porphyria, which basically is, well, so the rumor, the foundation of some of the vampire legends, is a disease where patients accumulate the precursors to a protein that we sort of all know, namely heme, which is normally found in hemoglobin. Turns out that hemoglobin, the heme group in hemoglobin, is used for other proteins and a vital function in enzymes that make steroid hormones. So here's sort of the link back to steroid hormones. So what happened in this particular nerve growth knockdown was that these animals couldn't make heme. And the cell tries to compensate for that and makes more heme precursors, and that's toxic. And these precursors are actually heme precursors that are fluorescent, but heme itself is not fluorescent. So when you expose them to UV light, you get this bright red, beautiful fluorescent signal. So now we have basically dissected this entire new pathway and found many new components that result in this porphyria-like disease in Drosophila. And it's the first example ever of a regulatory nerve growth factor linked to this disease. So nobody knows in humans of any link between nerve growth factors and porphyria-like states. The only known disease-causing genes are genes that have a defect in heme biosynthesis. I hope this sort of makes sense, but it's what happens in basic research. You open a door, you find a new phenotype, what we call a phenotype. So that's basically a new type of mutation, and it has very cool characteristics. And you follow up on it, and now I have to become an expert in iron and heme. And, I didn't know this like a year before that this is going to be the case.
You mentioned vampires. So how is this related to vampires? Can you elaborate on that a bit more?
Well, yeah. So this is a disease in heme production. So these patients don't make heme. So they are naturally pale. And the cells try to compensate for the loss of heme and make the more and more of these heme precursors, which is toxic. So they get these skin lesions. So they're very sensitive to light. So obviously they want to avoid light, and they're pale. So that there's two things that remind you of vampires. But then there's also, of course, the finding that if you give them blood, you can actually cure part of the symptoms because they can't make heme in the first place. So here you have sort of these three factors, light avoidance, pale skin, and cure through blood. That sort of seems to be an ideal ground for the vampire myth.
So do you think this will lead to a cure? What might it be? Can you speculate?
Well, yeah, so I'm not a MD, but one way one can think about is always gene therapy to replace the gene that's disrupted in the heme biosynthetic process with a healthy copy. And the other thing I can think of is that as I said, the cell tries to compensate and make more heme, but they can't do so. Now, fascinatingly, the same enzyme that's being upregulated in these patients is also upregulated in our flies. Okay? And we actually found a regulator for this upregulation. So it's essentially a heme sensor. And the way you can think about it is find a drug that targets this upregulator so that this enzyme doesn't try to compensate for it. That would at least take away the toxic effect and probably would at least partially cure them, for instance, the skin lesions. And those are the things, we're trying to do with Drosophila research to do the groundwork, and then clinicians can figure out, how to apply it.
When do you think you might publish this?
It's complicated because it's a fascinating story. We have now discovered seven new genes in this pathway, so we can actually split this. And the question is now, how are we going to split the story? So I can see right now a split in two. I want to publish the main aspect with the nerve growth factor late next year. We have to close one loose tie, and when we got that, we have a very nice story.
Who would know that it would come from the lowly fruit fly? Thank you very much.
Thank you.